Qualitative Conversations, a podcast series hosted by the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group of the American Educational Research Association. My name is Bowden Robertson, and I'm a PhD candidate in educational research at the University of Alabama, specializing in qualitative methodologies, and will serve as the moderator for our episode. Our focus today will be the recent conference on culturally sustaining pedagogies to critique and reimagine teaching qualitative research that was hosted by the College of Education's Department of Educational Studies, Psychology, Research Methodology, and Counseling, and funded through the Spencer Foundation. Dr. Stephanie Shelton and Kelly Guide of the University of Alabama received a grant for the conference, put tons of planning and coordination into it, along with an invaluable support of April Jones and Carlson Kugler, who are both graduate students here at the University of Alabama. The conference brought an array of scholars to examine culturally sustaining approaches in teaching and conducting qualitative research. Our episode's guests today are graduate students in the Educational Research PhD program at the University of Alabama who are also specializing in qualitative methodologies and who attended the conference and will focus on their experiences from the conference and their process of understanding culturally sustaining pedagogies and their impact. We're very happy to be participating in this today. And we'll start with introductions from our guests, April Jones, Venus Watkins, and Ren Bornhoft. If you'd please introduce yourselves.
Hi, everybody. I'm so glad to be here. My name is April Jones. I am a doctoral candidate in the program at the University of Alabama that Bowden has just mentioned. My research interest centers areas of child welfare and juvenile justice, specifically surrounding issues of social work and social justice, along with the marginalized communities that engage with the, and intersect with those particular systems.
Hi, my name is Venus Watson, and I am a PhD candidate at the University of Alabama with a focus on qualitative methodologies. And my research interests include Black girlhood, Black womanhood, and identity. I'm super excited to be here with you guys today.
Hello, my name is Ren Bornhoft. I am excited to be here. This is my first time ever recording a podcast, so... I am focusing on issues surrounding disability and educational access in informal education settings such as museums, covering both K through 12 and adult to a certain extent since museums have mixed audiences. So looking forward to all our discussions. And I'm a PhD student.
That's also important, right? Well, thank you guys all for joining us. So we'll start with the first question, which is I guess kind of obvious. So in your opinion, what does culturally sustaining pedagogy mean?
So in my opinion, culturally sustaining pedagogies, they're teaching methods that do more than just accept or include a student's cultural backgrounds in the classroom. So they aim to support and keep those cultural practices and identities alive and growing. This approach understands that students come from diverse cultural backgrounds and that these differences are valuable and they should be nurtured, not just acknowledged. It's like saying, your culture is not just welcomed here, but it's essential to our collective learning and growth. So it's just an emphasis on our cultural heritage, perspectives, experiences, and keeping those in mind to enrich the classroom environments, just contributing to the overall multifaceted educational experience for everyone.
Okay. And so now that Venus has basically given us like, did you write that in like an encyclopedia or something? Is that because that was like just perfectly succinct? Like, you need to take this recording and submit it somewhere.
Really? I said I was going to answer that question, so I was thinking about it.
Nice. April, did you have something to add to it?
Yeah, and I just want to make sure that, you know, the audience is aware that this is different from culturally responsive pedagogy, right? Like, you're not responding to particular things in the classroom. It's a sustaining issue, is what Venus has already mentioned. You want to make sure that the audience and the students and the people in that space feel valued and they were already thought of before they entered the classroom and not an afterthought.
That's really great. Ren, did you have something to add? Sorry, I didn't know if you were saying something there.
Oh, I was agreeing with the succinctness of Venus's initial explanation, but I do appreciate the sort of distinction between responsive and sustaining, because that is actually something going into the conference that I was slightly confused about. It got cleared up as we were discussing things, but I had heard of culturally responsive. I had not necessarily interacted much with this idea of sustaining. And I find it a very sort of exciting concept, because culture covers so many different aspects of student diversity, even teacher diversity and things like that. So.
Yeah, absolutely. So we can move on to the next question. So how did the conference impact the way that you feel about culturally sustaining pedagogies and or reimagining qualitative research?
Is it okay if I...
Yeah, go ahead.
So... honestly, the whole conference, I was very excited. I just sort of kept building, because I realized that one of the things that I'm really interested in doing with my own research is including sort of these concepts, because obviously disability and access have a number of different intersectional nodes that sort of meet and then part and then sort of circle each other. So for me, this was opening up a whole new window of sort of ways to think about both my own research and the field of museum education in general, because museum education has sort of a complex history of being both, you know, white-centric, male-centric, ableist, and all these other sort of elitist mentalities that we're dealing with still, and the repercussions of, even, you know, in our current situations. And so this, I think, needs to be something that the field of museum, just in general, museum studies, needs to be aware of and embrace more.
Also, I think something that really stood out to me was overcoming fear and having the confidence to step out and do things differently. I think we all get into like this routine of what's familiar and doing things the way that those before us have done things. But this conference really highlighted for me the importance of coloring outside of the lines and stepping out on your own and just being bold. And it's okay to do those things. And so that's what I appreciated most about it.
And I think for me, it brought up this element of the continuous self-reflection and what is required when you're trying to engage in culturally sustaining pedagogies. And I will also say practices, right, as well, because this can extend outside of the classroom space and teaching and education. And so I think making sure that you're always constantly checking yourself and reflecting on what you are doing or are not doing in different spaces, especially within the classroom, is very, very important. Otherwise, the culturally sustaining concept gets lost. And then unbeknownst to yourself, continuously reproduce the same thing over and over again because you fall into just a pattern or a habit. So, you know, echoing what both Venus and Rand have already stated, you need to step out of your box, but you also need to make sure that what you're trying to do in your practices are present in different spaces across the educational spectrum, which will also include, you know, museum sciences, classrooms, and social work as well.
And also, you just made me think of something else. I know that it can be scary to do those things, but as we are continuing to grow and learn, it's important that we go out and we create these safe spaces for our students to feel comfortable to do those things so that later they become, you know, the professors who are able to, again, create environments for their students, and it just kind of continues. I think that's something else that was important to discuss at that conference. And also, I don't know if I've said this already, but everyone in that space was growing and learning. I think sometimes we look at professors and we're like, oh, they know everything. And it just showed me that they're also in a position to learn and grow. There were things that they learned about different methodologies and strategies and how to handle and interact with students that I hope will continue to influence the way that they move forward in their careers.
That's all, yeah, that's all really great. You know, and that also resonates, like, you know, those themes of kind of like rejecting the traditional, going outside of the comfortable, you know, not reproducing. Those are things that, like, when I first saw that, you know, that they were doing the conference and what the theme of it was, and, you know, kind of started to, you know, think about, you know, participating in it, my first thought was, like, and this happens a lot, I feel like, with me and my interest in research, is, like, I was, like, thinking about culturally sustaining pedagogy, and immediately that kind of, like, sets off this bell of, this is for people that do critical work in the sense of marginalized populations, et cetera, et cetera. And that's not an interest to me. Those are values that I definitely agree with and how I, you know, want, like, how I envision society and things like that. But I didn't think, my first thought was, you know, this is a really great opportunity for me to go to this conference and, you know, present at it. But I really don't know if I'm going to get anything from it, if that's kind of the angle. And so, and I found out that I was wrong. and yeah, like, and as, like, you know, currently I'm writing my proposal, that I'll be, emailing later today to my advisor. And, you know, part of what I've wanted to do for a long time is to do something uncomfortable, right? To do something in research that is not traditional. It's like, you know, we have these tools, right, that are, like, kind of in these toolboxes, these methodologies that we, you know, pull from the, you know, SAGE handbook on qualitative research, you know, whatever, and we're going to do semi-structured interviews, and we're going to do a focus group, and we're going to do this and that and whatever. And it's like, you know, we do those things and they just, you know, like April was saying, it's just like a reproduction of what already was. And I didn't really kind of get into, like, conference engagement theorizing mode until it was some point during the first day during one of the panels where someone brought up this quote that's often, I've heard it since, like, day one of grad school. From Audre Lorde, about that quote about the master's tools will not tear, or the tools will not tear down the master's house, or however that quote goes. And, you know, for me, that's what that space came to represent at the conference, was, like, this is a space where I can, like, kind of think about doing those things that are outside the box, even though I'm not doing this kind of, I'm not doing that kind of work that's, like, critical in that sense. There's still, like, in my area, there needs to be, like, a reconfiguring, a re-theorizing of how methods are being taken up and how they're being used and how they're being, and especially how they're being taught, because I think that's a lot of how it is in a lot of qualitative methodology classes. It's like, a lot of students go into those classes thinking, okay, like, how do I need to do the research? Give me the steps, give me the tools, give me the things, and I'm going to put it all together into this, you know, neat little package and produce knowledge. But, you know, that's kind of like one of my main takeaways from it was like, that's, and it's something that I've been, you know, internally kind of going through, but, you know, having the experience of seeing, you know, really established scholars at the conference also dealing with that and grappling with that. You know, when they're some of the people who they're the tools that we pick up off the shelf from the people that were in the conference or they were in the audience, right? Those are the people that we're citing, who kind of, you know, literally wrote the book on X method or whatever. Yeah, Ren, go ahead.
So actually, that was one of the things I really appreciated about the conference was, obviously, we still had people doing sort of PowerPoint presentations, but it was nice to see the people presenting try to include some of these culturally sustaining pedagogies and practices in how they actually presented. So in short, the idea that they did not necessarily replicate what we would consider the standard presentation format, where it would have been honestly inappropriate for that to be the default considering what we were discussing. So the use of different materials and interactive elements and the subject matters and how we were having that conversation felt much more engaging than several conferences I've been to in the past, where I see often it's just the one person stands up, they lecture at the group, there's question and answer, you go your own way. And so that being sort of not ignored, but subverted in many ways was really refreshing. And I would definitely enjoy conferences more with that sort of mentality.
Yeah, yeah. I was at a conference one time and somebody, you know, think of how, you know, wild this idea is. The person presenting actually wanted us, gave us some, puts like some data on the PowerPoint presentation, and then asked us to talk with the people beside your, you know, to talk to people sitting beside you in your row about how you would go about, you know, theorizing around that data. And like, it was literally like a collective groan that was let out from the audience, like in this huge auditorium, because it was like, that's not what you're supposed to do, right? You're supposed to have your PowerPoint ready, go up there, do your talk, you know, take some questions, tell everyone, that was a very thoughtful question, I really appreciate it. I'll have to get back to you on da 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 da. You know, and yeah, I loved that about that. You know, the sessions that were presented at this conference were, it's like, it's almost like, I think like every single one has some type of like, okay, here's the stuff, now let's do something, right?
And it made us actually have to talk to each other and make, you know, those connections with other scholars. And that way we were also able to learn from their perspective, their backgrounds. I just thought it was a really nice way of pulling together everything. And even during some of the times where it could have been challenging or was challenging, it made us really look at ourselves and say, okay, in what ways are we not meeting this standard? And we were able to talk about them. But it happened because we had those hands-on experiences and the openness to be able to communicate with each other. It didn't seem like we were sitting in this very strict place. Like, we were encouraged to open up and learn from each other.
Yeah, and I think something, it's just kind of a running theme throughout what you guys have been saying, is it was slightly uncomfortable, but it was very necessary, right? Like, it's stepping out of the box in a very non-traditional conference type of format, and some of the engaging activities might not have necessarily been super comfortable. Like, not everybody wants to play with a puzzle or, you know, write a poem or poetic response to a presentation, right? But those are the practices that we engaged in, and I think that kind of anchors and speaks to what culturally sustaining pedagogies is intended to do. I think sometimes people get confused and they see the word culture and all of a sudden it's like, oh my gosh, it's only critical scholarship, or it's, you know, always only focused on specific marginalized and minoritized communities, and they close themselves off unnecessarily. And so people need to start to think about that term a little bit more broadly, right? Like, culture is culture. You have cultures and subcultures within cultures. And so there are levels to this. And we're just trying to make sure that you're creating a space, an engaging space, a valuable space where everybody is welcomed and their thoughts, ideas, and practices are going to be respected and valued. And I think we have to continue to reiterate that both as students and also future scholars in academia as well.
I just want to say I love how you phrased that, April. I absolutely love how you phrased that. So, because that's one of the things that comes into my mind is that too often I think that people see the word cultural and they assign it to a very specific type of group interaction. And that's not the point. I mean, so like you said, culture comes everywhere. I mean, you don't call it pop culture for no reason. Cultures can exist around any kind of shared interest, shared identity. All of these sort of different intersections can have cultures and subcultures. And so I just wanted to say I greatly appreciate how you phrased that. It's something that I think about a lot, especially, like I said, with the disability bend, because we do have so many other intersectional spots. So.
So one of the things that came up there is we're talking about these sessions, and so it's kind of a perfect segue into the next question. So what were some sessions or a session that stood out to you during the conference that you felt like were particularly impactful for whatever reason?
So I wanted to actually talk about the puzzling frameworks panel, since that was mentioned. And so my table absolutely went all in on this sort of puzzling. And the idea behind the panel was, you know, how do we start teaching and how do we proceed as we're going? And so we were given those puzzle pieces, initially a bag with no edges. So, because it's such a standard way of starting a puzzle that we had to rethink how we were approaching it. And it's not a complicated method of sort of portraying this idea and this focus, but it's so well executed. And then later on during the presentation, she gave us the edge pieces and we were able to continue. But it was really interesting to see the different reactions to the sort of puzzle experience throughout the room. So like I said, obviously our table was really into it. We were all sort of like, we have to finish this. It's not an option not to. And I still love Dr. Shelton's reaction of, nah, I don't like puzzles. That sort of like vehement, nope. And but I still think that Dr. Shelton was able to get something out of that experience. Like you said, April, even though it made some people uncomfortable, I think that is where the growth comes from the most.
And even when they came by and gave us the end pieces and then gave us the pictures so that you can kind of see where you were headed, some people still chose to try to figure it out in a different way instead of reverting back to the original ways that we would try to complete a puzzle. And I thought that was pretty impressive too.
Yeah, our table definitely was like, nope, we're continuing. The edges at this point will come last. There wasn't even a moment of disagreement where I was just sitting here going, just looked at each other and went, let's do this.
And I think I was one of those people that continue without looking at the picture, but I also think it made me think about what people and individuals bring to the classroom and the research space, right? Like, you're not going to know everything about your students. And you might see the physical presence of them, which could be like the meat of the puzzle, but you're not going to see their edges or, you know, the outer things that make them up to be who they are and that they're bringing into that space until you engage in certain practices in the classroom that allow that discussion to come forth, right? So while I appear and I am a Black identifying female, right, but you don't know the other subcultures and sub identities that I carry with me, those intersecting spaces, until you make space and make room in particular environments for that to show up and be present. And so while I think it was challenging, right, because we didn't finish our puzzle, but I kept going and I was just determined to continue because I wanted to make sure that I grew. I also kept in mind, oh man, this is kind of reminiscent of what everything else that we're interacting with in the classroom could and does look like on a regular basis.
So on that topic of classrooms, I don't know if you're like using our questions that we pre-designed as a cheat, if you are using them as like a cheat sheet. But on that topic then, so how should we reimagine the qualitative coursework? We've all taken the, you know, kind of like the standard classes and, you know, the elective classes that are required for our degree programs. What are some ways that we can reimagine that coursework to include culturally sustaining pedagogical practices?
So I think that in general, one of the big issues that I noticed in my qualitative one, and also going back and having done some grading for, you know, preceding qualitative one students, is the issue around language and how we talk about our discipline. And this is not just an education issue. I come from an art history background, and trust me, we have jargon that has jargon. Like, it's nested layers of unnecessary complexity. And I understand where that comes from in academia, but I feel like, especially in qualitative one, we've got to work on the accessibility of the content, because we're getting people from different backgrounds. I did not come in with an educational background, so a lot of the philosophers and the theorists were very foreign to me. I had at least, like I said, some experience with, okay, I've got to try and figure out all this jargon, but it made qualitative one more complicated than I think was necessary, even though the teacher that I had at the time was fabulous, but it's just, I can tell that they were working with a structure that was already in place, and that inherently, I think, is part of the problem, is that we have these, well, it's been done this way for so long, this is the way we've got to do it. And small changes, you know, can get made. But I think that in the cases of at the very least qualitative one, we need to tear it down completely and rethink it from the beginning. And encourage both people in the field and people coming into the field to write in a way that is not elitist and exclusive.
I agree with that. I always find it kind of funny that a lot of the research that takes place, like involving teachers or students, may not be accessible to them. And so it's like, how do we bridge the gap between research and being a practitioner if we do not write and share in a way that's relatable, that's easily understood, that's friendly for everybody? And that's one of the reasons why I really enjoy Dr. Tolliver's work. The way that she writes, pulling us in with story work, makes it to where the reader has so much room to come to terms on the topic themselves. It just makes it accessible for anyone.
I agree with both of you guys, and it makes me think of this term that I have to use when teaching GTA. And in teacher ed, they talk about universally designed practices a lot and accessibility a lot. And I think that's kind of a little bit of what you guys are speaking to, making it accessible, planning in advance on what this needs to look like, how this needs to be presented, so we'll reach multiple people, most of the folks in the classroom, and not just a small group of people that understand and can process jargon, especially academic jargon, in a very specific way. So I appreciate those insights. Thank you.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree. I agree with Ren. Let's tear it down and reimagine it. It's funny, like I think back on my coursework and kind of like where I was at, just in terms of like my researcher identity when I took Qual 1. It was my first semester of my PhD program. It was before I switched to educational research. I was in a different program, and I didn't have very good advising, and I had my program of study form, and the way that the forms are done for the College of Ed, the first thing, kind of like the first little section there, is research methods classes, and I mistook that to be the order that I was supposed to take my classes in, and it was kind of like a really lucky misstep, because for the first year of my program, I didn't take anything kind of like related to the context of curriculum instruction. I took classes on I took Qual 1 and Qual 2 and statistical analysis classes and things like that. And so, but to me, when I was first in Qual 1, and Dr. Guy was teaching the class, I thought she had us do an exercise where we had to do, and I think this is a pretty common across qualitative one courses, whatever it's called in different PhD programs, where, you know, you have to interview someone about something. You have to kind of design some research questions or some interview questions, a protocol, and then there's always the dreaded transcription that comes afterwards, right? I definitely remember. But after we completed our interview, we came into class, and she had all these art supplies, you know, like color crayons, markers. I think there were some watercolors and some, you know, some type of like sketchbook type thick paper that you could use the watercolors with. And she wanted us to, she wanted us to draw about that experience. And I remember thinking to myself, is this what grad school is? Is this what we're supposed to be doing? Like, I'm supposed to be here at this PhD program that's supposed to be, you know, this is like the highest level of education, right? And I'm supposed to draw a picture? Like what's going on, right? And I thought it was literally the most useless thing that I'd ever done. And I was like, this is like something's wrong here. This is not, you know, whatever. And then kind of, I don't know, maybe that was like at the very beginning of the class, like probably one of the first few sessions after we had done our interview. And then later on in the class, we like she held on to the drawings that we completed, and then like we revisited it. And that drawing is like, I still have that drawing hanging up in my office at home, because it has been like basically the way that I kind of illustrated that interview process became so emblematic of my experience as a researcher and came to mean so much. And, you know, and so I think about that as like, I know in retrospect how important that exercise was, right? And so I wonder about the specifics of you know, the way that I came to that methodology class was very much like a toolbox approach, right? Give me the tools, show me how to do an interview, show me how to do this and that, and then I'll go do it. Tell me it's good or not, and then I'm going to do it and get my letters behind my name, right? It was definitely like it was a means to an end. And you know, the way that Dr. Guyot was teaching the class and making us engage in those things that made us, you know, think about our positionality, think about those experiences, definitely don't fit those needs of students who are just wanting, show me how to do it, right? A good PhD or a good dissertation is a done dissertation, right? Like, I don't care about all the other stuff, right? And so I think it's like, it's difficult to think through, like, how do you, from like, if I'm put in charge of a class like that, right? Like, how do I rethink that class to not be so like complex, like Ren was talking about, with all of these, like, you know, philosophical, et cetera, you know, you have to know this concept and this term, and you should have been reading, you know, you should have started reading Dewey, you know, 15 years ago before you even got into the program, or, you know, whoever it is. How do you work around both of those things? Sorry, that was a really long explanation. Ren, do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, well, so there's sort of building off what you were saying, so I was just sort of thinking about it. I think that qualitative one really and truly should be teaching you how to be open to what is different, and not necessarily a rundown of here are these, you know, big names, here are these sort of thought processes, let's throw all these terms at you. But I think that Qual 1 should focus on breaking that mold of this is what this has to be like. So I think that, and as a huge fan of Dr. Guyot's various arts-based strategies. But it pushes people outside of that traditional academic comfort zone. And I think there needs to be more of that in Qual 1 to sort of prepare you to absorb the knowledge that's coming later. So that when you are learning about the different, you know, Dewey or Butler or Rod, and these are all, you know, important people, but that way you can still come into it not necessarily inherently thinking that their word is the law. So thinking outside the box, thinking critically, but also just sort of figuring out where you fall and how you favor approaching problems and issues and things like that. Not that we won't still learn as we go through the classes, but troubling that idea of you need a toolbox, here you go. I think we need to focus on how to create your own tools, or how to be open to different tools that you might not have even thought would go in a toolbox for educational research.
I think what makes that introductory qual class so tricky is a lot of times there are students in there who are only there because they're required to be there for to meet some type of requirement from their department, but not because this is something that they actually want to explore. And for me, I think what would be the most helpful is teaching students how to think for themselves, right? Because I know for me, it really shook my world for people to be asking me questions like what I think about something and not just telling me what to do. Because throughout schooling, it's like, these are the ways that we do things, and there's a right way and a wrong way. So it really shook my world to think through some ideas and be asked my opinion, and it'd be okay for me to have an opinion and it not agree with whatever the person in authority had to say. And so in that beginning class, I think that it's important to encourage students to think for themselves and build an understanding based off their own beliefs and not what someone is telling them to do. But then, like I said, it gets tricky because for people who this is their only research class that they have to take in order to be able to go out and do their dissertation, they need to know like certain terminology in order to be able to do those things. So there needs to be some type of balance or restructuring so where people can get the basic terminology, but also have the space and the opportunity to come into their own as a researcher and building their own researcher identity.
So, yeah, I like the terminology. And yes, it is. It's still important. And I think that people have to come into their own. So it can get complicated. But, and I think that part of it is also that, you know, it's like you said, people in Kualan can come from other disciplines. They can come from the quantitative side. And even then, we just, quantitative people, I think, especially have an issue where they fall into that same, they have these specific methods they can use and how they present it. But I still think that that would benefit from, like you said, teaching them how to think for themselves, how that independence of sort of generative work comes in. So I think that was well phrased.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, with the thing with, like, you know, terminology and whatever, I think that there's a certain part of that is, you know, this is, it's like, these are the knowledges that came before us, right? This is what this, you know, we enter the space of academia, and there's already these like circulating ideas and discourses and whatever. How are we to rewrite? How are we to generate something completely different if we don't know where we're starting from, right? We have to be able to, and I think like a certain, you know, there is like kind of a certain responsibility that those classes have for, you know, kind of introducing people to those things. And yeah, a lot of it is incredibly dense, complex, you know, things that, you know, you feel like, oh man, I should have read like, you know, 20,000 pages before I even thought about applying, right? Because it's like you're playing catch up, and it can be really daunting to do that. But it's like to a certain degree, you have to know what those things are so that you can, you have to kind of know what they are so you can start poking holes in it. If you want to make something new, if you want to tear it down, you have to know it well enough to be able to be able to articulate it well enough and kind of, you know, go through it. So you're not, yeah, that's kind of like with me and my experience with quantitative research is like, I took the classes and I know just enough about it to like really get myself into trouble when I'm talking to somebody who actually knows it really well. So I don't really like to get into those conversations, right? Because I don't know what the heck I'm talking about. But I think it's important, you know, in those classes that there is kind of a certain like onboarding that you need to, you know, you need to be aware of, you know, certain types of discourse or certain, you know, certain figures and the terms that go along with certain, you know, ways of thinking and stuff like that. And it can be tough, but I think it serves a good purpose.
Really quickly, I think echoing everything you guys have said, I think it's important to have the foundation and also trouble it as well at the same time, right? So like that balance that came up, making sure that you're having both and not just one. And so what happens in qual one is that it's only the one sometimes, and people get lost in the one. But that would be the space where we start to trouble it with a little, like sprinkling in a little bit of ABR, like Dr. Guyatt engages with, right? And then making sure that you're incorporating more scholars of color, so it doesn't come in like qual two and you're like, oh wait, you know, there's scholars of color, scholar out there producing really good scholarship that I can pull on. Is there anybody else? You know, it's not a surprise. And pulling on scholars that are doing disability work and disability studies and research and those international scholars, so other students will see themselves in that space. And I think that's what makes it and starts to build more on that culturally sustained pedagogy. If you start to sprinkle it in and it's not just like, because once the folks that are outside of Qual leave Qual 1, they're not going to hear it again, most likely, because they're not going to engage with that space. And so the best time to reach the most people would be Qual 1. And that's when you need to sprinkle in a little bit more diversity and culturally sustaining practices in there.
Yes, I agree. And then that made me think of like this question too, like who decides what's important for beginners to know, you know? And so I think it's important for us to really start thinking through that and troubling that as well.
So regarding that, actually, so currently I'm taking the Intro to Educational Research course. So it's a BER 500/600 or something like that. But that seems like the class that's a basic introduction of sort of quantitative and qualitative research methods, writing a research proposal, things like that. And I think that course actually does introduce a lot of the terminology. I also learned some of that in our ProSem, which is obviously department specific. And so that's why I was sort of thinking, like, if there's that sort of introduction to the field class, that's a good spot to learn some of those terminologies. And so I think that maybe encouraging people from other fields to take maybe just a basic research course instead of specifically like qualitative one. And because each department obviously is going to have their own sort of focuses and structures. And most programs have a research methodologies class that focuses on their scholars. And so, well, or at least that's been my experience so far. I would hope that many departments have that. But so yeah, and I think that is something that I don't know if we take that into account necessarily when people are coming in. So I think that's why I like your ideas about the having different kinds of authors, even learning about some of these sort of theorists that are considered foundational through the eyes of these other communities. So, you know, learning about them through Black scholars, through disabled scholars, through feminist scholars, it still gives you that sort of core information, but it gives it to you with more, I think, relevant context. Not that the original work isn't important for what it contributed to the field, but as a way of also acknowledging that our perspectives on these sort of foundational greats change as we learn more, as we grow more as a field, as individual scholars. And so I've found that throughout all of the qualitative classes I've taken so far, I actually prefer the sort of learning about those authors, sometimes through their own words, but also really, like I said, through other people's perspective. It gave me a lot more layered nuance in how to sort of deal with the subject matter.
I feel kind of left out because I feel like that class wasn't offered when my program started, so I never took it. It sounds like did anybody else take that class?
I did not take it.
That must be something. I guess that's something new that they pulled out. Maybe I should take it. I'll have to talk to my. What'd you say?
I said, now I'm confused. Well, so it's definitely something I had to take. I thought ProSem was originally this same class, and it's not. So I will admit, a little bit confused by that. But I think that...
Yeah, I took ProSem.
ProSem is not the same course, although I did a lot of the same things in ProSem that I'm doing in this current class. And also, not necessarily the class in question I'm taking now uses Creswell, who's not my favorite. But... So...
Yeah, I know a lot of people who share that opinion as well. But yeah, I mean, that sounds like a good idea if they have a class that kind of serves more of like introduction to those things. I think that could serve a lot of really good purpose. you know, because yeah, I think like I said, I feel like kind of I missed out a bit. So that brings us to the last question. We talked about reimagining qualitative coursework, but how could you describe ways in which that culturally sustaining pedagogy could extend beyond the classroom?
I think when we think about like teaching and teaching methods, it's only in classroom experiences and processes. But when we're in the doctoral program, our learning extends into other spaces with committees and committee engagement, with how we engage with our research process, and also the mentorship that takes place inside and outside of those spaces, right? And so I feel like culturally sustaining pedagogy extends into the engagement with your committee and your committee members, the process in which you use to be able to select your committee members, your engagement with your advisor as well, and also in conferences, like we've been talking about, like we were talking about this culturally sustaining pedagogy within the conference space, but that space was also a space of learning. So it was also a form of pedagogy. So culturally sustaining practices needed to be present within the conference space at the same time, right? So it's not just limited to classroom environment and teaching in a very strategic, traditional K through post-grad types of experiences. And I think we need to make sure that we remember that and that both our advisors are engaging in those practices and we're, you know, being upfront about what our needs are. If we're not explicit about it and they don't know, that we're letting them know and we're being honest, both with ourselves and with them as well, on what we would need to be able to feel like we're sustained culturally throughout our process in the PhD program.
Adding to that, I think we should consider the ways that we are engaging with communities and just family engagement. Like when we think about like our research, like projects or, you know, research studies. And when we think about the ways that we partner with schools and how we are engaging with our students to go out and do those things. So I think it extends beyond the classroom because we need to take into consideration the cultures of the families and the communities that we're going out to, and not just take into consideration, because that's not, we already said that's not sustaining, but really, you know, making it known that it's essential for us to embrace it.
I think, like, for me, I can't help but think about my past experience doing a research assistance for grad students and faculty, and thinking about, you know, the way that the appointments were set up, people would, you know, make appointments, meet with me to talk about, hey, you know, I want to use, I don't know, you know, what's the deal with theoretical framework? Like, you know, how do you apply it to, you know, something? And we have, in the appointments, we have an hour, right? And I thought about this a lot after the conference too, about like how I, you know, even though I believe in let's tear it down, like, right, let's dismantle it, let's whatever, given kind of like the confines of what I was supposed to be doing, I felt like I always wound up reifying those things, especially when, you know, we're available for research assistance. We were available to the UA community at large. So we had, which is a really good thing, because I could see, you know, how people in like nursing were using qualitative methodology, or in like world language studies, or, you know, whatever. It was a really cool thing. But it's also like a thing of, a lot of the times the students would approach the appointments in this very like toolbox mindset, right? Of, I need this, like, I have this knowledge, I need to get it from you. So I'm going to ask you these questions, you know, how do I put my theoretical framework in my research questions? How does it need to show up in my chapter two? How does it need to show up, you know, here? Like, tell me the points, right? And, you know, it's kind of like a thing of, I wanted to give them something that was valuable, and you kind of try to assess, like, what is the person's need? What are they going to be able to get out of what I'm telling them? But, you know, sometimes I felt like, or more often than not, I feel like I relied kind of on this, like, okay, well, if you're talking about, you know, X, you know, concept, whatever it is, you're going to want to cite so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so, and you're going to want to use, you know, the blah, blah. Like, it was just kind of like this, it was almost like the, you know, after like a year of doing that, it was like most of the appointments were honestly like just pre-rehearsed. Like, I should have just recorded them and put them out. It would have saved me, you know, probably having to meet. And you know, like, part of it was, you know, like, I'm a grad student, I'm doing my own stuff, I'm trying to pass comps, I'm trying to take my coursework, and I'm also doing this job. I don't have a lot of time, but, you know, another part of it is, you know, like, how much use are they going to be able to get out of what I'm telling them, right? Like, if I, you know, because doing this stuff that we're talking about, right, like, those scholars that you want to cite, those underrepresented scholars, that might not be the people that show up on the first page of Google Scholar, right? You might have to dig for it, right? And it takes a lot of work to do that. And so it's like, sometimes I think back on that experience and I'm like, man, like, I really did a disservice to a lot of people, because I was just basically giving them this kind of like toolbox approach, right? But, you know, I think it's hard to work with someone and, you know, they send me their stuff. I usually spend like, you know, 30 minutes, spend 30 minutes to an hour looking over it, and then meet with them for an hour. And it's hard to fit a lot of stuff into it. But yeah, I think that, like, I don't have that position anymore, but I think, like, you know, if I had to do it again, I would try to set it up where there's more time to engage in these things, right? Where I can actually set up something that is not this, you know, okay, if you're using critical race theory, make sure that you cite so-and-so, make sure you cite this person, make sure you talk about this tenet, that's going to be, you know, your bread and butter, so to speak, right? Like, it shouldn't be like that.
Yeah, that just makes me think about, again, that question, like, who decides what are the important things to know, and how do they come to that determination? But then also how you were talking about some of the people who we should cite are not on the first page of Google Scholar, and thinking about just experiences as a grad student. A lot, like, my focus in my work is on Black girlhood, Black womanhood, and just thinking about theories and methodologies. The people who my work would best align with are not the people who typically we are taught in those classes. So it makes it a bit challenging when you get to these big milestones. Is like, oh, I haven't learned this. Well, I was supposed to learn this outside of class. But not knowing what I don't know, and not knowing where to find the things that I don't know can be a bit, you know, frustrating. But I will say that I know in our department, from the article Somerville et al., since that, they have tried to take that into consideration and implement just more diverse readings and articles. But still, the truth of the matter is that there are people, whoever they are, at B, who decide, oh, these are the people who you need to cite if you want to be taken seriously. And that's sad, right? But then on the other side, as grad students, sometimes it's scary to to trouble those things, because it's like, well, I know that I need to have this many articles, or I need to be doing these things. So it's like, well, if I jump out and I do something that's not in line with the ways that it has been done, am I going to be accepted? And that's, it's always a lot of tension when you start thinking through all this stuff, like how do we really reimagine qualitative research when, if we're scared, you know, and if we're not sure if the people who are making all the decisions, whoever they are, will even accept the way that we're trying to trouble and reimagine things. Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. I think that kind of speaks to the tension and, you know, nuance that has been brought to the conversation just stemming from the conference in and of itself, right? Like, even in the conference space, I think we weren't left with any solidified answer on how to do this work. It was a lot of, these are spaces that need to be addressed in order to move the needle forward in doing this work. And it's not going to be perfect. And you're going to have to go back and do some self-reflection and some evaluation and see how you can make it better moving forward. So there will be mistakes, kind of like with anything, and some missteps and some really hard lessons to be learned in the process, unfortunately. But I feel like the overall theme or idea or concept behind it is to make sure that you're bringing in the people that are on those edges, that are on the fringes of the conversation, that are not truly visible, bringing them into conversation directly, intentionally, with respect and value. And it's not just, let me throw this one, you know, scholar of color in here, or this one disability scholar in here, or this one international scholar in here. I'm literally thinking through this with very specific intentionality, because I want my students and my peers and my committee members, my colleagues, to feel like there is space for them within the academy, within this qualitative research methodological practice and pedagogical practices as well. So I think it's a work in progress, but it's doable. It's just not going to happen overnight. And that's what's most frustrating and slightly annoying.
So as we're sort of talking this, I kind of want to offer a challenge, I think, to the more established people who are in academia, as, you know, we are all grad students sort of coming through this environment, and I can see the changes and I can see the improvements, but I would also challenge you to trouble the older generations that are not as receptive. So when you have professors who are still sort of stuck in those old ways, or telling people or telling their students that, no, you have to do it this way, those are your colleagues. They'll eventually be our colleagues, but we'll still be in a position where it could be dangerous for us to speak out or speak against these individuals. So when you're seeing behavior in colleagues that is detrimental to these ideas of, you know, culturally sustaining pedagogies, or sort of these holistic practices that we're talking about, and these rethinkings, challenge them. Don't necessarily accept that they're set in their ways, but challenge them. Don't let them color your students' experiences in sort of the professional field as they're learning and growing, because it can be incredibly disheartening. And I think that that is something that would go a long way to sort of cementing that concept of culturally sustaining pedagogies, is fight for your students, because we're not in a position all the time where we can do it for ourselves.
I think that's a really good point. And I think that, you know, everything that's been, you know, I agree with everything that's been said here today. I mean, the conference was really a good chance to kind of, you know, to to engage in this, in these ideas, as we, you know, like as Ren said, like, you know, we're grad students today, but we are the future, faculty, at least those of us who, you know, are wanting to go into faculty positions, you know, so it's important that we, you know, we keep these things in mind, you know, moving on. So so I think we're about at the end of our time, so we wanted to go ahead and close out, but I wanted to thank again our panel guests, April Jones, Venus Watson, and Ren Pornhoff, for taking the time out of their incredibly busy schedules to join us for today's episode. My name again is Bowden Robertson, and thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time for Qualitative Conversations.